Hi, thanks for checking out Press Play and our podcast. And when you're done with this one, I have another one that you're going to love. I just know it. It's a podcast about design and architecture, cars, gadgets, all sorts of things that make up our built and beautiful world. It's hosted by someone who is an insider who knows everything about design and architecture, Frances Anderton, and the podcast is called DNA. It's on KCRW's iTunes page, so check it out.
The green light.
The distance she gets on this particular vault is about 22 feet.
She has two vaults, remember? Oh, boy. Yes!
She has done the best vault of her life!
There it is!
She did it!
10, the gold medal! The gold medal goes to Mary Lou Retton. Oh, what a party they'll have in Fairmont, West
what
Virginia tonight.
What a night is that?
Gymnast Mary Lou Retton vaulting her way to gold in L.A.'s 1984 Summer Olympics. Today, L.A. is making another bid to host the Summer Olympics, the 2024 Games. Mayor Eric Garcetti was in the Bay Area this morning, along with several others, trying to convince the U.S. Olympic Committee to choose Los Angeles as the official American candidate. L.A. is up against Boston, San Francisco, and Washington, D.C. Robert Livingstone is an Olympics historian and founder of GamesBid.com, which is focused on Olympic host city bids. Welcome, Robert Livingstone.
Good afternoon.
Well, the mayor and his delegation have been pretty tight-lipped about the specifics of their pitch, but what do you think LA's strongest selling points are?
Well, there's a number of things. There's some iconic venues that already exist, and there's some new venues that already exist. So, you know, those are key things. There's not a lot of construction that needs to go on, but I think the heart of their pitch might be that, you know, they've hosted twice before, so they have that kind of that intellectual legacy. They know what they're doing. They know what works, what doesn't work. And the USOC, they're looking for a comfortable place, a place that they think will win on the international stage, and it's worked with L.A. before. Recently, they bid with Chicago and with New York, and it didn't work out so well. So, you know, maybe that comfort factor is going to be big here, and maybe they'll go with a partner that they know well.
So that wouldn't be seen as a negative that the city has hosted in 1984 and 1932, that they wouldn't want to give it to another city who hasn't done it yet?
Well, had you asked me that a few years ago, I might have agreed. But London hosted in 2012. That was their third try, and those were really successful games. Tokyo's hosting in 2020. That's going to be their second time. So it looks like the IOC doesn't shy away from repeat hosts. And, you know, if that's not a negative for the IOC, then it might work out well for the USOC.
Well, what are some of the things that the committee generally values? Do they look for cities that are diverse, have some kind of narrative, that look good on television, that have existing facilities? What?
Well, all those things are true. It's really complex. So they're looking for a city that's going to appeal to IOC members. There's about 100 IOC members that vote in a secret ballot. They're from all over the world, obviously. They have their own agendas. They belong to their own organizations. They have their own interests. They each have their own idea about what the perfect Olympic Games will be. So, you know, like you mentioned, diversity, that's going to be important. They're going to have to also prove that they can deliver all these things. And I think LA's experience will play into that in a big way. But it's really, you know, up to the city to show that they can form a good partnership with the IOC over the next 7, 8, 9 years as they prepare for the Games. Because they become partners, they have to work together well and produce a good Olympic Games.
And we've seen in previous Olympics that that has been a strained relationship between the IOC and some of the host cities. What financially is the IOC looking for?
Well, they're looking for financial guarantees. So typically in the past, they look for generally the federal government to underwrite and to guarantee the costs of the Games. Now, I know in the United States, it's a different model, and generally they're privately funded. That's something that the USOSA has been working on. So, you know, the IOC looks for those guarantees. They don't want to be stuck with the bill at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. I don't think that'll be an issue with the United States. I think they'll be confident that it'll be a good partnership and it'll be a financially viable partnership.
Okay, so the other cities in the running, Boston, San Francisco, and Washington, D.C., are they strong competitors for Los Angeles?
Well, they're, you know, they're all good cities, and it really depends on what the UFOC is looking for. I know there's a lot of vocal opposition in Boston, and that might be a little difficult for the UFOC to deal with. That was a similar situation when Chicago lost last time around. There was a lot of opposition, and it caused a problem for them. For Washington, it's a great bid, but the issue there is on the international stage, Washington's just too tightly connected with politics, and it might be a drawback. There might be a optics issue that the UFOC would have to deal with. And San Francisco is a very appealing city on the international stage. The venue plan might not be that great. There's the temporary stadium that would need to go up. Venues are spread across a wide area. That will be a challenge. But definitely San Francisco would be a strong bid, and I think it would probably do well on the international stage.
Well, is it possible that the U.S. Olympic Committee won't choose any city?
Well, they've said that is a possibility. I find it hard to believe. I think this is a window of opportunity for them. It's been several years since the last games in Salt Lake City and in Atlanta. They've put a lot of effort into this. They've been doing this the last year and a half, first sending out invitations to prospective cities, and then they've gone through this process of vetting each city, shrinking it down to a list of four, and now going through these presentations. I find it hard to believe that they're going to say no, because I don't know how they could do any better at this point. If you wait to 2028 or perhaps go for the Winter Games in 2026, you know, there might be other opportunities, but, you know, you can wait forever. I think this is a window of opportunity. I think they have to go for it at this point.
Okay, so when are we going to know who they chose?
Well, so they're going to decide today, from what I understand, later on today. They have a press conference scheduled for 4 o'clock, and they're going to decide whether they're going to bid yes or no. At that point, they can announce what city they've chosen, or they may not have made up their mind in that respect, so they might delay that decision until January or further along. At least that's what they've told us.
Okay, well, we'll have to wait till this afternoon at the very earliest, and just a couple of hours from now. Robert Livingstone, an Olympics historian and founder of GamesBid.com. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Now, there's no question that hosting the Olympics is a prestigious gig, but do the financial costs outweigh the benefits? Let's take a look at the impacts of the 1984 Games with Helene Elliott. She's a sports columnist for the LA Times. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, we were just talking about the bidding process. Hosting the Olympics, obviously something some cities, many cities covet, but it wasn't always that way. I understand in 1984 for the 1984 Games, there was only one other city in competition with Los Angeles, and that was Tehran.
Exactly. The Olympics were kind of in a down cycle at that point. Politics had been so overbearing, and boycotts, and the 1980 boycott certainly brought politics into the conversation more than some people wanted it to be. And the Olympics were actually, as a movement, as an extravaganza, were actually kind of in trouble. And the 1984 Olympics and the financial model and Peter Uberoth's planning are generally credited with saving the Olympics because of the financial and competitive success those games were.
Well, what did Peter Uberoth bring to this Olympics to make it different from previous Olympics?
Private funding, corporate. He made it the corporate Olympics. A lot of people will kind of say that maybe it was too corporate, that the Olympic Games have swung too far the other way towards so much corporate involvement. But as your previous guest was talking about, you know, in a lot of other countries, the governments guarantee a lot of the financials of the games, and that's not the model that we use in the U.S. So the money has to come from somewhere, and Peter Uberoth and his group were extremely successful in bringing in all these corporations and creating all these different levels of contributions and different levels of presence for these corporations. And it didn't cost people money and, in fact, made so much money that there's still a legacy going on now. I mean, an incredible program for amateur sports, for coaching, for youth sports, is still being funded by the surplus of the 1984 Los Angeles Games.
So this was the first Games to make a profit in more than 50 years?
I would have to go back and look that up, but it was certainly a huge profit. It was certainly more than people had anticipated. And again, they were so wise in terms of reinvesting it back into the community that it's still paying a dividend today and still allowing kids to try sports for the first time in Los Angeles and around the area, refurbishing parks, providing sports equipment. The LA 84 Foundation has just done an incredible job reinvesting that money and making the Olympics not just a distant memory, but a living memory and still part of day-to-day life here.
But the cost of hosting the Olympics has gone up significantly. Just the Winter Olympics in Russia last year in Sochi were around, what, $50 billion? And maybe more than $50 billion, we don't know the exact amount. But in L.A. in 1984, it was something like $400 million.
Well, the games have grown a lot since then. Not only the number of participants, but the number of sports, the number of venues, and that's something that is part of the LA bid. Is LA is very proud and can say, "Hey, you know, we have so many existing venues. We don't have to spend a lot of money to build new venues. We have so many places. Not only some of the venues that were, you know, used in 1984, but look at all the places that have been built since then. You've got Disney Concert Hall. You've got Staples Center. You've got what's now known as StubHub Center. All these venues could certainly be used for the Olympics and didn't exist in 84, and you wouldn't have to do new construction as you might have to do in other cities."
One of the biggest concerns at the time was the potential gridlock the games might create. And I think that didn't come to pass because so many people were afraid of those warnings and left the city if they could.
And
it
was very civilized. Yeah, I had a lovely conversation with Anita DeFrance a few months ago. I did a story on the 30th anniversary of the opening of the 84 games. And she was saying that one of the things that people don't realize is that it took a lot of agreement from private companies to arrange for deliveries to be made from, instead of, you know, like 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., these companies would make their deliveries from like 11 p.m. to 7 a.m. So it got them off the road. It got these big trucks and a lot of traffic off the road during the day, and they were able to make necessary deliveries around the city, not just to the Olympic involvement, but, you know, just to normal stores and everything else. They were able to do it at off hours, so it staggered the traffic, and the traffic was much, much better than anybody thought it would be.
Yeah, well, there is a lot more traffic these days, and there are a lot more people, so I don't know if that could happen in 2024.
I think, you know, you picture this civic pride and try and come up with a traffic plan like that again. I suspect it could work.
Well, what about the money? A lot of people are concerned, at least in other cities. Boston has this group that says no thank you to the Olympics, mainly because of the money that it's going to cost. And we saw what happened in Greece, in Athens. I think the cost of staging the Olympics there is partly what led to Greece's financial problems later on. But are people concerned that L.A. will overstretch itself? I mean, there's a lot of infrastructure that needs to be taken care of in the city right now without spending money on new Olympic facilities.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, people will position it as, you know, our kids don't have adequate schools and don't have adequate books and things like that. Why should we spend money in the Olympics? And it's a difficult argument, and I can see both sides of it, but I think that, having the Olympics here positions L.A. as, or repositions L.A. as a world city, as a place of tourism, as a place that can get things done, as a place that, is a world-class city, not just sports, but all the Olympics usually have cultural exhibitions that run alongside the athletic events. So there's something for everybody. I certainly understand the idea, don't spend public money on the Olympics, and I think that that's part of the L.A., the strong point of the L.A. plan is that, again, so many of these venues do already exist. The main expenses are construction. You would not have those kind of expenses for an L.A. bid.
Mm. Well, when you look at the other cities that are competing, San Francisco, Washington, D.C., and Boston, do you think that L.A. Leads the pack in terms of its potential for getting this bid?
That's a really good question, and it's impossible to answer because there may be people within the USOC who say, you know what, I like this idea of reusing the venues. But there could be others who say, hey, you know what, LA's had it twice. It's somebody else's turn. You know, people could say that, well, LA knows how to get it done. They did the 84 games so successfully. But again, it's just this idea that you want to spread out the idea of Olympic hosting the Olympics. They call it Olympism, just to share it among a number of cities, not just LA.
Hmm. Okay. And do we have someone like a Peter Uberoth waiting in the wings to run the thing?
I suspect Casey Wasserman will play a very large role in this. I'm curious if Tim Leiwicki might come back and become involved in it. I'm not sure about that, but I know for sure Casey Wasserman will play a big role, and I think that given his position and his name and his involvement in the city, I would expect him to be able to get a lot of things done.
I think he was up there with the mayor this morning.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, thanks so much.
Thank you.
That's Helene Elliott. She's a sports columnist for the Los Angeles Times. Well, what do you think? Do you think the Olympic Games would be good for Los Angeles in the year 2024? Why or why not? Give us a call at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can join the conversation on Facebook. Coming up on the program, car companies want to sell a lot of trucks. And they are, but they're also required to make a certain number of fuel-efficient cars, which are not selling as well because gas prices are so low. We'll talk about that and what the valet does when he gets behind the wheel of a sports car. That's next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. The price of oil has fallen below $60 a barrel for the first time in 5 years. And this, of course, leads to the low gas prices we've been seeing everywhere, which seems like a good thing for both drivers and car makers. But while cheap gas is leading to more sales of some vehicles, it's actually not all good news for the manufacturers. Matt DeBord is here to explain. He's transportation editor for Business Insider. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Madeline.
Well, last time we spoke, we talked about the upside of low gas prices for car makers. So people were buying bigger gas-guzzling vehicles and more of them. What's the downside?
Well, the downside is that, you know, the car makers have been planning for a world in which gas costs $4 a gallon, not $2 a gallon. And the federal government has also mandated that all the car makers across their fleets hit a certain, you know, MPG standard. So they've been planning for that as well. And that means they need to have more small cars that are more fuel efficient. They need to have more electric cars if they want to build those. They need to have more hybrids. They need to have more plug-in hybrids. They need to make their big trucks and SUVs more fuel efficient. So they've invested in all these things. And then out of, oh no, gas is cheap again. And the problem here is that people don't want to buy these cars that they're making. So while it's good for the car makers on one side in that they can sell a lot of big trucks and big SUVs and make a ton of money, it's bad in that they've invested these resources in a whole different type of automobile, largely so that they can meet the regulatory standards. And it's a big question right now whether the people are actually going to buy these cars. Mm. So they're just going to sit there unsold. And this is not a good thing.
Yeah,
so
I was wondering about that.
It's a bit of a debate. Is
there a big supply problem and oversupply problem of these kinds of cars?
Yeah, I mean, the way that the auto industry works is you can't just, you know, say, okay, we're going to make 10 cars today or something like that. You know, once you turn on the assembly line, you're committed to making cars in a certain volume. And yeah, so they do have cars right now that are not selling anywhere near as well as they anticipated they might be, you know, based on the situation with gas prices a couple of years ago when they had to commit the resources and the planning and the engineering and all that stuff to actually building the cars. So, yeah, it's a bit of a problem. Although, you know, the pain, I guess, will be eased somewhat, at least in the short term, by the fact that they're making gobs and gobs of money off the big trucks and SUVs. And really, if you're the Detroit Big Three, you want to be making trucks and SUVs. That's what you're good at. This is going to have a little bit more of a profound effect on car makers like Honda and Toyota and Nissan, the Japanese car makers, the Korean car makers, who have a lot more small cars, a lot more fuel-efficient cars in their portfolio of vehicles.
Well, overall, though, this has been a really good year for car sales, right?
Oh, yeah, it's been fantastic. I mean, you know, the worst year was the 2009-2010 period when sales completely collapsed and, you know, like 9 or 10 million cars, new cars altogether sold in the U.S. This year, we're liable to sell something like 17 million new cars and trucks. I mean, it's just fantastic. They're dancing in the streets in Detroit and in the car making centers of Japan. And they're even pretty happy. You know, the European market is not very good right now, but they're even real happy in Europe because they sell a lot of European cars in the U.S., BMWs and Mercedes and Audis, vehicles like that.
Okay, let's talk about this next story. It sounds like something out of Ferris Bueller's Day Off. It's about a man who used a dash cam to catch a valet who was taking some liberties with his Corvette.
It's just like Ferris Bueller's Day Off. That was the very thought I had. You know, the famous scene where they turn the Ferrari. You know, this has happened to you, I'm sure, Madeline, right? You've turned your Ferrari
all the time
over to the valet.
I know.
And you just, you don't know what they're going to do with that Ferrari.
It's true.
Right? General Motors, Corvette, the company that makes Corvette, they actually address this problem by incorporating some technologies into the car that allows a driver to drop it off and put it into valet mode. And this, you know, this enables you to record how fast the car was going, and it lets
Wait,
you use
well,
the
I just love the fact that they assume
on.
That the Corvette drivers use valet so often that they have to have a valet mode. I mean, what?
That's right. It is an assumption that you make, right? And the other thing, too, is that not only do they use valets all the time, but they're scared to death
of their
that the valets
yeah.
are going to do something bad with their car. Well, as it turns out, recently this guy did turn his car over to a valet in California, and it was in valet mode, and the valet takes it into a parking structure and does a little acceleration test of the car and gets it up to over 50 miles an hour in a parking structure, in a straight part of a parking structure.
And you see
and
this from
me,
your,
when
you
this car.
But you see it because it's from your point of view. So the camera is faced outward on the passenger side. So it feels, when you're watching this video, like you're actually driving the car yourself.
It does. It feels like you're right there in the car. And believe me, it is very, I've had this car, I've driven this car. It is very tempting to go fast in this car. You know, it really wants to go fast. That's its whole mission in life.
But I can see this as an upside for parents whose teenagers are driving their car, if they had a camera there just to see what happens.
This is just a particularly exaggerated example because this is Corvette. But you can see like a whole lot of, I guess what you might call surveillance technologies coming into cars because cars are gathering data. There's a lot of video in cars now. You know, in places like Russia, people have gotten really accustomed to having dash cams going on their cars all the time because you never know when they're going to wind up at some checkpoint and they're going to be harassed or there's going to be some shakedown by the authorities. One of the more interesting stories that has emerged over the last couple of years is the degree to which Tesla, you know, the electric car company, has very, very interesting tracking technology so that they know what's going on with their cars all the time.
All right, let's talk about something a little less exciting, and that is the color choice of car buyers. Predictably boring, or maybe unpredictably boring. But the top colors for new cars in 2014 were, number one was white and number two was black.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
it's a little. It goes all the way back to the Model T. You know, Henry Ford, when he introduced the Model T, oh so many years ago, he said you can have it in any color you want as long as it's black. and it doesn't appear that the consumer has really fought that directive that much because obviously there's an organization that keeps track of paint colors in cars, and they discovered that the number one color is indeed. And this is worldwide. This is not just in the U.S. This is white is everybody's favorite.
Has it ever been anything but white or black? As number one,
not to my knowledge, it's always been. It's I mean, white has always been very popular in the U.S. In the U.S., colors are like silver, gray. I mean, black and white are obviously very popular as well. It's interesting to, you know, wonder whether colors like, you know, these more exotic colors that pop up from time to time, like yellow, has yellow ever had its day? I mean, obviously, we know some people really
with
like
a Corvette,
red cars,
it has. So, yeah. Matt, do you have a car?
Well, I used to. I don't have a car anymore.
Oh, because you're in New York.
Not since I moved to New York City. Yes.
If you had
a car,
the
last car I had was...
What color was it?
I had a Saab. That was my sort of junky driving around car, and it was British Racing Green.
Oh.
A very sexy color for a car.
Okay.
Yeah, I always wanted a British Racing Green car. I got one at long last.
Mine is called champagne, but I just think it's dirty silver.
Yeah,
but
you know,
I like that they call it champagne.
Well, you know, there's a whole thing with brown cars, believe it or not. Brown is a very controversial color in the car world, and some people really like brown cars. Champagne being kind of a, you know, sandy, shiny brown color. But there's some people who really just love, and I'm one of these people, love like brown Porsches, you know, really, really sexy, yeah, hot, fast cars
nice.
That are brown.
It's like a little piece of chocolate.
That's right. A little piece of chocolate that goes 0 to 60 in 4 seconds.
Matt DeBord is transportation editor for Business Insider. Thanks, Matt.
Pleasure as always, Madeline.
Well, what does your car color say about you? Tweet us at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, why China is paying for Chinese language and cultural centers at American universities and why the universities are welcoming them. Some say the money comes with strings attached, though, namely soft-pedaling the more unsavory aspects of the Chinese regime. That story is coming up next after a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. At about 90 universities and colleges in the United States, China is funding the study of Chinese language, history, literature, culture. These centers are called Confucius Institutes. UCLA has one, so does Stanford. But a recent hearing in Congress has raised questions about whether these Confucius Institutes are having a negative influence and limiting academic freedom. A couple of colleges have already closed their institutes. Perry Link testified at the hearing. He's a former professor of Chinese language and literature at Princeton, and he now teaches at UC Riverside. Welcome, Perry Link.
Pleasure to be here.
Also joining us is Randy Kluver. He led the initiative to establish a Confucius Institute at Texas A&M, where he is Executive Director of Global Partnerships. Welcome to you, Randy Kluver.
Thank you very much.
And let's start with you. You opened the Confucius Institute at Texas A&M, and you're back now as its interim director. And I know all of them are a little bit different on each campus, but how would you describe what happens at the Confucius Institute at Texas A&M?
Our Confucius Institute is a little bit different than many in that we do some Chinese language instruction, but it's primarily focused on non-credit-bearing community classes, folks who from the community who just want to learn some Chinese. But we also do a lot of cultural outreach. We do lectures, seminars, speakers, as well as the normal cultural events, Chinese New Year, things like that.
And Hanban, the Chinese government agency that organizes and funds these institutes, does it approve of the curriculum in any way, select faculty, teaching assistants, anything?
No, not really. Their directions to us are pretty vague. They say teach Chinese language, do cultural outreach. Beyond that, it's really left up to each local institution to decide what they want to do with it.
All right, let's bring in you, Perry Lincoln. You have some concern about these institutes. What are they?
They do supply curricula at many of them and teachers that come from Beijing, and their mission is to present a rosified view of Chinese society and history. That means, at the bottom line, that certain topics can't be addressed. Taiwan independence, Uyghur revolts, Tibetan autonomy, the Tiananmen massacre of 1989, the Falun Gong movement, the immense wealth of the very top elite in China. Recently, the Occupy Central events in Hong Kong, and the list always changes, but you don't address these things, or if you do, under straitened circumstances. And the problem here is that it gives to the students or the adult audience, as at Texas A&M, a cameo view of China. Not that it's false, but that it's incomplete.
Mm. Do they actually come out and say you cannot talk about these subjects?
No, for the most part not. This is understood because they provide the funds, and the people who run the centers, both the Americans and the Chinese who run the centers, know that, of course, you don't use these funds to talk about the Dalai Lama or the Tiananmen massacre and so on.
And Randy Kluver, is that something that you would disagree with?
Yeah. With all due respect for Professor Link, we just don't operate under those rules. We have taken on many topics that perhaps the Chinese government would be less than thrilled about, including Tiananmen Square. We've done all kinds of discussions on China's military buildup, on the demographic challenges facing China. But what we do is we do programming that is relevant to our community, that is academically respectable. We work very closely with our own faculty experts. The teachers that Professor Link alludes to, actually, those folks come from our partner institution. We vet them, we choose them, we invite them over. And they operate under our rules, not ours under theirs.
And so, Perry Link, do you think Texas A&M is then unique or an outlier in terms of what the other Confucius Institutes
do? I think Texas A&M is a quasi-outlier, yes, because Randy Kluver's already sent me a poster that shows that they did have a discussion of the Tiananmen massacre last June, which is extremely unusual for Confucius Institutes. But I would point out that even that discussion is hardly a square look at the massacre. I'll read you the first line from the poster. It says, "The events of Tiananmen Square in 1989 represent one of the most vivid examples in recent history of a conflict of political narratives." And then the narratives go on to say there are the reports of the victims and the families of those who were massacred, but there's also the Chinese government's narrative. Well, you know, this is a bit odd. The civilized world, ever since the disasters of the 20th century, has come to understand that for certain things, like the Berlin Wall or the Holocaust or things like this, you don't just put up one narrative and post it against another narrative and then shrug your shoulders and say, well, there's two narratives here. So that's the kind of constraints that my colleague Randy Kluver has to work under, even if he dares to mention the Tiananmen massacre. He has to present it in this essentially false, even-handed way. As soon as you concede to the Chinese government that, oh, yes, there's two different narratives and there wasn't necessarily really a massacre, you've made a very large concession.
Mm. Randy Kluver, what do you say to that?
I just got to disagree with Professor Link. That's, in fact, not how we presented it. We said here was how the Chinese government viewed the movement. Here was how the student protesters viewed the movement. Here was how the U.S. government viewed the movement. What we did is we looked at three different visions of what happened, and we allowed the audience to reflect on their own experiences, many of whom had been protesters. So I understand his concern, but I think, regardless of the content of that particular issue, I think it's important to say, look, everything in China has a political overtone. There's a heavy layer of politics, and Professor Link knows this very well. And so I would not purport to say there is no political intent on the part of the Chinese government. The real question is, does that compromise in any way the academic integrity of an American institution? And I would argue that, in fact, it does not, because the Confucius Institutes really respond to their local audiences, and they do what their local institution wants them to do.
But why not just have a center that is not affiliated with China and doesn't take money from China, and then you wouldn't have to worry about any kind of concern regarding academic freedom?
Well, let me address that by saying that my perspective is perhaps a little bit of an outlier, because I do tend to pay a little bit more attention to Chinese politics. Most Confucius Institutes, and perhaps this is something that Professor Link would object to, they really don't see that as within their remit. Their goal is to focus on Chinese language teaching. And so they just don't get into politics, regardless of the Chinese government view or whatever. The Chinese language curriculum is provided, tends to be the level, hello, my name is David. What is your name? It's non-political. Now, you can take the next step and say, look, everything is political. And in fact, you can say that. But When we started the Confucius Institute, Texas A&M, it was to bolster our own Chinese language programs. It allowed us to build our program up to a level of critical mass where we could hire our own faculty to do that. Once our program had gotten to a sufficient level, then our university was able to make the investment to hire our own Chinese language faculty. And at that point, our Confucius Institute transitioned out of teaching four-credit Chinese language to doing more of the cultural programming that we're doing now.
And Perry Link, what do you say about that?
In general, I won't say this is just Texas A&M, but in general, the Confucius Institutes are more, for an American who doesn't know the China field, the best way to think of them would be as infomercials. You know, even the New York Times sells space on its op-ed piece for ExxonMobil to express something. And the best examples of these, of course, are on television, where we have half-hour infomercials. Now, is there truth in infomercials? Sure, there's a lot of stuff. But they have a slant, and they have a goal, and their purpose is to lead you to a certain view or to buy a certain product. When we bring these things on U.S. campuses, we have to ask a number of questions. One is, do the students realize that these are infomercials? And number two, even more broadly, is that what we want on our campuses? Do we want competing infomercials? Is that what we mean by a marketplace of ideas? Most universities reject that in principle, but that's what the Confucius Institutes are doing.
I'm wondering, I'm wondering, though, if it is possible, in your opinion, to just teach the language and to steer clear of any kind of political or historical lessons that might prove controversial, or is it basically the sin of omission that if you're not talking about it, then you're making a political statement?
I think it's both. If you describe anything only in part and don't look at the other part of it, then A, you've omitted something, and B, the part that you describe looks different if the part that's undescribed is left out. So that's a problem. And secondly, I won't speak about Texas A&M, where Randy Kluver knows better than I, but I've talked with teachers at other Confucius Institutes, and they come over with missions. They are trained and instructed about what you should say and shouldn't say, not only in the classroom, but as representatives of the party state going abroad. And these people themselves have to calculate, if I make a misstep and if I say something wrong, then when I go back to China, will I have to pay for it? So none of this whole enterprise can be understood if you don't see the goals of the Communist Party of China at the core of it, because they are.
Now, Randy Kluver, the American Association of University Professors, they're not supporting these institutes anymore. They think they should no longer exist on these universities. And I'm wondering if you've had some soul searching there at Texas A&M and wondered whether or not you should continue the relationship with the Confucius Institutes.
Well, certainly we are unhappy with the fact that the Confucius Institutes are largely being understood as a propaganda device and we're all drones of the Chinese state. I think all of us are a little unhappy about that. But let me give you another example. The Confucius Institutes often sponsor trips for high school students or college students to go to China. Professor Link is exactly right. When those students go to Tiananmen Square, no one is going to give them the history of the 1989 movement. But it does give them an exposure to China, its culture, and then we can explore in other contexts what the larger geopolitical significance of that is. We think about the Confucius Institute, its mandate to our university, its mission, and certainly we think if this is not useful to our students, to our community, then there's no reason to continue it. We're certainly not, you know, taking on an additional workload just for the fun of it. I think, you know, and I know a lot of the Confucius Institute directors across the United States. As a matter of fact, many of us gathered in China last week where we had our discussions. And I think I can say unequivocally that if any of them felt that their integrity had been questioned, that they were receiving any sort of mandate from Hanban to do or not do certain kinds of things, that they would shut down. I mean, I would be the first to say, let's shut it down. Because we really don't need that kind of intrusion in the university curriculum.
What is it, then, if you're not presenting a viewpoint that China likes, what's in it for them to continue funding these institutes?
Okay, let me talk about that in two ways. Number one, the Chinese government really does see it as having a geopolitical importance. They talk about it as a part of their soft power. But just because Li Changchun, the head of China's propaganda bureau, wants that to be true doesn't make it true. The American academic culture is very robust, it's very self-protective, and it's very committed to the principles of academic integrity. I don't know what the impact of a Confucius Institute would be in another country.
And Perry Link, what do you think should happen with these Confucius Institutes? Would it be possible to rework them to make them more appealing to you? Or do you think they should all be shut down?
I think that the U.S. government should pay for Chinese language instruction to American students, yes. And I don't think that not just China, but any authoritarian state should be able to set up infomercials on U.S. campuses and have students regard them as part of the normal teaching of independent American universities. That's a fundamental conflict there. And could I just note that, you know, Mr. Kluver says that there are no pressures and that anyone would close down his or her Confucius Institute if there were. But if you look around actually what's happened, none of them talk about the Dalai Lama or the Uyghurs or the Falun Gong or the Tiananmen Massacre or the all of those other red line topics. They're just not there. Now, is pressure felt? Well, you tell me. It's not written down, no, but it doesn't happen among all 90 or among all 400 around the world. So something is happening.
All right. Well, we'll leave it there. I want to thank you both very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
That's Randy Kluver, Interim Director of the Confucius Institute at Texas A&M, and Perry Link, Chair for Innovative Teaching and Comparative Literature and Foreign Languages at UC Riverside, and he joined us from the studios of KUCR. I said earlier that UCLA has a Confucius Institute. We asked them if they wanted to come on the show and talk about it, but they declined our request to do that. Never declining my request to come in the studio and talk about his program is Warren Olney.
Always ready. I can't think of a better thing to talk about on your program or anywhere else. And, you know, the Sony hacking story just will not go away. A couple of developments today. One is a class action suit has been filed on behalf of 47,000 or 42,000, I forget which it is, employees at Sony because due to negligence, claim the attorneys. They were subject to a possible identity theft. Their social security numbers and other personal information, of course, is now available to anybody. And another development as well, one of the executives received an email from an organization which may or may not be the hacking group threatening the showing of the picture, the interview, when it premieres in New York on Thursday and on other occasions as well. So it's in broken English. It's sort of designed to make it sound, at least, as if maybe it is those North Koreans after all. But nobody knows.
Nobody knows. Well, and Sony doesn't know, or they don't know? They do know.
Well, if they do know, they're not saying. They have, however, revealed what I just said. Although, yeah. I guess that's part of the hacking. I guess the emails to the executives are still available if you want to go check it out.
Right, and they keep promising more and more data dumps as the days go on.
Yeah, and there was a Christmas present promised. Maybe this is it, you know. Maybe they are going to, in fact, try to intimidate people at showings of the film. Nobody really has a good idea of it at this point.
Okay, well, look forward to that. The latest on the Sony hack at 1 o'clock with Warren Olney and To the Point. Thank you. And coming up on this program, one paragraph in the 1,600-page federal budget puts an end to federal prosecution of medical marijuana users and sellers. We'll talk about that next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Santa Monica. KCRW is listener-supported. Help us continue to create and distribute our unique content. Go to kcrw.com/join to donate. And thanks.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The Senate this weekend opted to pass a funding bill that'll keep the government open through next summer. And here's one thing that got the green light. medical marijuana. There's a provision buried in the 1,600-page bill that defunds the federal prosecution of medical marijuana users and the people who run dispensaries. This one paragraph may have just lifted the federal ban on medical marijuana. Josh Voorhees is a senior writer at Slate. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us what this provision says.
Well, basically, it specifically blocks the Department of Justice and the Drug Enforcement Agency from spending a single dime on any type of prosecution of either patients or medical marijuana dispensaries in states where medical marijuana is legal.
So basically, giving states the green light to allow medical marijuana, the feds won't do anything to prevent that.
Assuming that the dispensary is in complete accordance with the state law and not running afoul of those, like if they were some suspicion of trafficking outside the state, for instance, they still might be targeted. But as long as they're kind of in good standing with the state, the feds seem as though they're willing to stand by and let them go.
And what does this mean for prosecutions that are already underway?
So that'll be kind of the big question. There's obviously a more than a handful still kind of circulating through the courts. It would appear as though the way that the law is structured, that they'll have to drop those cases or at least put them on hold. It would seem as though the spending bill itself goes through September. So in between now and then, clearly the federal government, the DOJ, could spend any money prosecuting those. So it's still a little unclear whether that means they'll just hold out and see what Congress decides to do when it comes to renew this again, whether they cement this permanently or whether they drop it, depending on how the negotiations go. But by most accounts and most kind of experts suspect that this would mean to an end to the prosecution of those cases.
President Obama had already backed off this for the last year, from what I understand. So is this something that medical marijuana advocates had fought for it to be codified in the law?
Yeah, that was kind of the big thing. Last year, President Obama kind of instructed the DOJ to basically effectively gave the qualified green light to these states to kind of experiment. The thought was this isn't the best use of the DOJ, their funding and their resources. So the thought was, okay, states, if you're going to do this, do it as you please. We're going to be watching. But for the most part, we're not going to be making it a priority. The legalization movement, they were obviously thrilled with that, but the goal was really to kind of codify this into the law, and that's what this does. They've been pushing some version of this legislation for the better part of a decade, and for pretty much every step along the way, it would die in the House before it got anywhere. Then for the first time this summer, almost out of nowhere, it wasn't really on anyone's radar, the Republicans threw up a controlled House, passed it. It didn't ultimately move through the Senate, but it really kind of represented this first kind of watershed moment in the movement. Here we have Congress for the first time, as opposed to standing pat, taking direct action to basically endorse or sanction these kind of state laws effectively.
Why did they change their mind? And I understand that this bill was written by Dana Rohrabacher, who's a Costa Mesa Republican here.
Yeah, I believe they worked with Sam Farr, too, who is another California lawmaker. It's kind of interesting to look at the politics involved here. It's an oversimplification to just say that Republicans are, you know, now on board with legalization, and when this provision didn't get its own vote in the larger spending package, it was kind of buried among, you know, these myriad other provisions. But when it came up on the House floor this summer, 49 Republicans voted with Democrats, which was a kind of a pretty noteworthy number. Of course, by allowing the states to experiment, it's not quite the same as endorsing legalization as much as it is this bread and butter of a large part of the Republican caucus right now, which is obviously the idea of state rights, and the less the federal government's involved at the local level, the happier they are. So that was kind of the ethos that I think drove this newfound support for the state efforts.
So medical marijuana is legal now in 32 states and the District of Columbia. So does it look like this will give a de facto green light for the rest of the nation to legalize medical marijuana?
Well, certainly if you were a governor or a state legislator in a state where it wasn't legal, one of kind of the concerns is always, you know, passing some type of state law that you know runs afoul of a federal one. And while the federal law still remains on the books, knowing that it won't be enforced, I think will certainly give a little extra shove to anyone that was on the fence. When we look at the polling data, legalization as a whole is has more support now in these last 2 years than it has, you know, since ever. Certainly since it had a previous high water mark in the 70s there. And I think you'll see kind of that push in general and that be reflected in the state houses. But specifically, if you break down the polling number, as much as there's support for legalization as a whole, the Americans are much more optimistic and, I don't want to say excited, but I guess more willing to embrace medical marijuana than they are retail at this point. So that's certainly seen as kind of the first step in any of these states as they move towards what at this point feels to me, and I think to the majority of Americans at this point, as inevitable. Whether that's a good thing or not, it's up for debate, but certainly it looks like that's the way the momentum will, the movement certainly is kind of moving downhill at this point.
Josh Voorhees, senior writer at Slate. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Jolie Myers, it's time to talk about what the listeners are talking about.
Hello, Madeline.
Hi.
First, most importantly, a call to action for our listeners. We're working on a show about holiday music, and we want to hear from you all. What's your favorite holiday song and why? Call us and sing a few bars of the song, 1-844-PRESS-PLAY. Don't forget to tell us why you picked that song. We really want to hear your beautiful voices on air. Come on, don't disappoint me.
Talking to you, George Michael. Talking to you.
Is he around? Our listener, George Michael. All right, so we talked about the Olympics on the show today. LA's making a pitch for the summer 2024 games, and we wanted to know what you all thought. Miriam Padilla on Facebook says, oh God, no. Traffic is already bad enough. The Olympics would be disastrous. But Richard Saavedra reminds us that the assumed traffic nightmare never materialized in 1984. And with an expanded metro in 2024, the Olympics could be very worth our while. Along those lines, Peter Amaro wonders if landing the Olympics would speed up the expansion of planned rail lines. Like, can we just finish the Purple Line already? Gabriel Avena says, yes, booking the Olympics would give a major boost to infrastructure investment. Naysayers, please crawl back into your dens of negativity. And from his den of negativity, Eric Torres weighed in. He says, no. But if they do, Eric says he'll plan a vacation around it. Out of town. He doesn't want to deal with the hordes of people, security, traffic, blah.
What do you think? Yay or nay for you?
You know I dwell in the den of negativity. I'll just leave it at that.
All right. The mistress of the den of negativity, Jolie Myers. Thank you very much. Warren Olney and To The Point is up next at 1 o'clock. I'm Madeline Brand. Have a great afternoon. I'll see you tomorrow.